Sunday with Miriam on RT Radio 1, sponsored by Travel Department. Explore the wonder of the world's most iconic sites with Travel Department, the world discovered together.
But first this morning, he has covered 10 US elections. He's CNN's chief national correspondent. Viewers have grown to love his magic wall. And coming from Dorchester in Boston, he declares himself 100% Irish, and he's coming back here in September. During the week, I was lucky enough to speak to John King, and I pointed out to him that the last time we spoke was in 2023, before the 2024 election, and his plan then was to spend a bit of time here meeting cousins and finding out more about where his ancestors came from. I wondered, how did he get on and who did he meet?
Well, I have cousins in the Dublin area, but they took me up to Connemara, which is where my grandfather came to America from, up in the Ballyculleeny area, Dunlochan. And it was really moving. It was really interesting. I know from my Irish friends, sometimes people cringe when they think Americans come back and say, you know, I found my home. So I don't want to overstate it, but this is something that I just didn't do, Miriam. We talked about it last time. I was so busy in my early life. My parents were busy, and we never talked about where we were from. So for me, later in my life, or my midlife, as I like to call it, I'm going to live to be 100 and something. It's just been an eye-opening experience just to understand a little bit about where my family comes from.
Well, we regard you as one of our own now. I mean, did you also feel, John, that you got more of an understanding of your grandparents and the lives they led, and maybe about the reasons they left Ireland?
Well, I think I understand now. I only have vague memories of my grandfather, and I think I told you when we last spoke, I'm not even sure if they're true, right? I was 5 or 6 when my grandfather died. And I remember, you know, he lived in a soldier's home in Chelsea, just north of Boston. And, you know, he would come for Sunday dinner or Thanksgiving dinner, and my dad would drive him home, and we would scramble to jump in the station wagon so we could take that drive. And in his apartment, I remember the smell of oranges. He always had a big bowl of oranges right inside. That's what I remember. I don't remember much else because I was so young. But from my dad, worked hard. We had 7 kids. We had very little money growing up. He lost his job a few times. He had some health problems. You don't understand it when you're a kid, but I've always had what I hope is a pretty good work ethic. And I got that from my dad, and he got it from his dad. It was crystal clear to me. And my mom as well, we don't know as much as about my mom's family history. And this is why I'm excited to come back, not only to have a great conversation with people in Dublin and with Galway, and to share ideas and to share stories and to just share experiences, but also to try to retrace even more of the family history. My parents were quiet people, but hardworking people, and I'm forever grateful. I lost them way too young. And so part of trying to retrace my history and learn more about where they came from is part of my way to honor them, because I can't see them today and say thank you.
Remind my listeners, John, about where you grew up in Dorchester. I mean, what kind of a place it was, and if there were a lot of Irish there.
There were a lot of Irish there, Miriam. So I was the King family across the street from the Doyles. The O'Briens were up the street. The Mackenzies were next to them. It was an Irish Catholic neighborhood, St. Mark's Parish in Dorchester, very much a blue-collar neighborhood. My father was a janitor. He worked in a chocolate factory we used to have in Dorchester at one point, and then he got a job as a court officer, and then as a jail guard. And he worked the overnight shift because it paid a little bit more money. So we didn't see my dad that much when we were kids. My mom had worked in a bank, which for a woman at the time was actually, she was a pioneer in some ways. Mm-hmm. She had a job as an assistant to a bank executive. But then when she started having children, she stayed at home for the hardest job there is in life, raising children. 7 children. But it was a fun blue-collar neighborhood and crowded with children. The thing I like to joke about is 7 children in my house and children all around the neighborhood, that as I got older, I finally realized how much when it's quiet, it's like, oh, I never had this when I was a kid. my mother was an only child, and she used to always say that, I remember a time when it was quiet and I miss it.
I love that. And, you know, as you mentioned earlier, you know, your dad was so hard working, both your mom and dad. They made sure, though, all 7 of you got a good education, didn't they, John?
It was very important to my parents. They were both high school educated, but they were also incredibly informed. And this is actually, I think, something that does connect you to Ireland when you learn more about it, is that my dad, you know, in those days, Boston was a three or four newspaper town, a four newspaper town, then became a three newspaper town. This is pre-internet, so it's hard for some younger people maybe to understand. But you had to watch, you know, the evening news at a certain time, right? That's when it was on. That's when you got your news. There was no cable television. There was no internet. And my dad watched the news every day, and he read the newspaper every day. And he talked about how being informed was important about your government, whether it's your local government or your national government. I was, you know, 10 years old when Watergate happened, a huge scandal in American politics. And that was sort of my eye-opening moment, watching my dad watch the news every day. An American president was being impeached. And what did that mean? And so that's kind of what got me interested in politics. My dad's interest in it, plus he was a union at the jail. He was involved in the union, and they were always negotiating contracts and having to talk to the mayor. So I just had eyes on things that fascinated me. But part of it was the value of an education, yes. And I think that one of the things is I've gotten to know more people in Ireland, and I think one of the gifts Ireland has is just this DNA commitment to a good, strong, basic, classic education. And especially in this age of globalization and an economy, we have no idea what the jobs are going to be in 10 or 20 years from now. And so some people say you have to specialize. I would argue that if you're a generalist and you're curious, that helps you when you have to sometimes reinvent yourself. I've been lucky. I've had a steady job in journalism for 40 years, but you know, we're the outliers, right? Mm. The younger generation is my own children, my older children. You know, my son has had to, he works in biotech. He's a scientist. And, you know, sometimes the companies boom and then they collapse. And so having an education and having curiosity and having resilience, I think, are sort of keys in the new economy. And I'm grateful my parents just told us, you know, get a good work ethic and don't be afraid when you get knocked down. Just get back up.
Oh, I love it. Now, listen, you've covered 10 U.S. elections as a journalist. How different was last year's to all the others you've covered before, John? Or was it?
It was both very different, but I also think sometimes, you know, the value of that experience, sometimes that experience is useless in the sense that our politics have changed so much. But sometimes there are threads that you can draw back on. And so a lot of people here in the United States, and I know around the world, were shocked. How did Donald Trump win the White House again after January 6th? You know, after the trying to essentially stay in power after losing an election, how did the American people possibly put a guy who, as I say, tried to steal the country? How did they then, you know, give it back to him legitimately? And he won the election, and he won it by a healthy margin. So why did that happen? Well, part of it was that, you know, President Biden disappeared, and we now know more about his decline. People were dealing with post-COVID and then high inflation and a tough global economy. And I think the biggest dynamic is take Trump's name out of it. In the thing where experience kicks in, Miriam, is in 11 of the last 13 elections in the United States, either the White House or at least one chamber of our Congress has changed hands. What does that tell you? Mm. You have a restive electorate that wants change. And so it's the same dynamics that brought us Barack Obama, a restive electorate that wanted change, that was frustrated with the Iraq war back in those days, frustrated with the financial crisis. So we get Barack Obama. And then we get Donald Trump. How's that happen, right? Well, people want change, and they're going outside of their boxes. So I know it's hard for a lot of people to understand, but I would even take Trump's name out of it and just say we are in a generation now, 20-plus years of American elections, where there's constant change. And I think that's because people are a little lost in the economy, not sure where we're going, and no politician has succeeded in sort of creating a North Star. And so both parties are struggling to find their footing, and the American people keep bouncing back and forth.
In relation to your current president, I remember you saying to me before, you know, that there's no real experts on President Trump because everything he did and does was unprecedented. I mean, if that was true then, John, it must be doubly so now, is it?
Well, he's, you know, he's back in power now, and we'll see, you know, I hope he's joking. He says every now and then that maybe he'll try to stay in power, but our Constitution says you can only serve two terms. And so we assume this is his last term. And in some ways, that's liberating for any president because you don't have to face the voters again. So, you know, is Trump the second time different from Trump the first time? In some ways, yes. The fact that he has gotten, at least for the moment, so annoyed with Vladimir Putin that he's supporting Ukraine, that's a big surprise and a shift, sending weapons to Ukraine. in the context of something that, you know, matters a lot to Ireland and the European Union, this sort of yo-yo. He's imposing tariffs, now he's pausing tariffs, now he's imposing tariffs. He's been back and forth. Tariffs is something he's always been consistent about, but I think he's hurting himself with the unpredictability of it right now. And so in some ways, he's the same. He's a creature of impulse. And he likes to be the center of attention. But I do think, and we're early, we're just about to hit the 6-month mark of Trump 2.0. So there's still a lot to study, but in some ways he is different. And I think part of that is that he won't be on the ballot again. And in some ways that's liberating. You don't have to worry about getting votes. You can just do what you want.
One of the really interesting things you did before the last election was to go to the battleground states, because I think you wanted to find out why people were switching from Democrat to Republican. I mean, you mentioned coal workers in West Virginia. Did those people speak to you, or did they shut you down when you said you were from CNN? I was wondering out of interest.
It's a great question. Look, there's been a polarization in our media. And I always say that Donald Trump watches more CNN than I do. and I watch a lot. I watch a lot of CNN. You know, I work here. But he politically, I get it. I think some people take it too personally when he attacks the media and he attacks particularly the network I work at. It's a political foil. It's part of his act. It's part of his the way he, you know, draws lines and tries to turn people against the establishment, right? We're the establishment legacy media, so therefore we're bad. Just like he says establishment Republicans are bad and establishment Democrats are bad and the banks are bad. And, you know, he runs against any big institution. So he has poisoned the well somewhat out there in the conservative parts of America, the Trumpy parts of America. But again, it goes back to the idea of, you know, things I learned as a kid, just keep trying. And so if you sit down with somebody and you prove to them that you're there to listen, some people will say, no, you're from CNN. But most people eventually, you know, once they understand you're actually there to listen to them, you want to hear their story. You don't have an agenda. Your only agenda is to learn from them. You know, my mother used to always say, you know, you only learn when you listen. It was her way of telling me to shut up, I think. But it's true. You only learn when you listen. And that's the gift of our job, right? The gift of being a journalist is we get paid to learn. And I think Washington and New York and Los Angeles, the big entertainment and media capitals of the United States, rush to judgment about Trump voters. Yes, there are some Trump voters who are on the radical side, who would storm the Capitol again, you know, if Donald Trump had lost the last election. Yes, there are some people like that. But there are a whole lot of people who used to vote for Democrats or used to vote for, you know, Ronald Reagan or George Bush style Republicans who just feel lost and they're looking for something different. And, you know, some of your listeners might think, well, Donald Trump fooled them. Maybe. But they're so disenchanted and so lost that they're looking for something different and they don't trust the parties. And sometimes they don't trust CNN. So I think journalism globally is under a challenge because of misinformation and disinformation and artificial intelligence. And I think the best way to deal with that is to do what I'm doing now, is spend more time on the road just listening to people and try to build trust the old-fashioned way, just by spending time with people and asking them about their lives.
And John, when you think of Boston, where you grew up, I mean, did you find with your own friends, neighbors, even family, that there were people maybe who used to be staunchly Democrat, but they flipped in the last election? And if so, could they explain to you why?
It's mostly lack of trust, and the answer is yes. You know, I grew up in a very blue-collar Democratic, Kennedy Democrats, right? People were in most houses in Dorchester, there was a picture of the Pope and a picture of Jack Kennedy. Well, a lot of those people then voted for Ronald Reagan. And a lot of them now vote for Donald Trump. The biggest change in American politics has been people with a high school education who have not gone to college, who work with their hands, you know, they're plumbers, they're mechanics. They used to be Democrats because the Democrats were identified as the party of the blue collar worker, the party of the little guy, the party of the struggle. And the Democrats have lost that connection, in part because they've improved their standing in the suburbs. But if you go out into blue collar America, including Dorchester, Massachusetts, you will meet people who used to be Democrats who say the Democrats have become elitist. The Democrats have become the party of the rich. And I think the Democrats, understandably, because it's part of their agenda, have let themselves be defined by, you know, certain issues that where they might not have majority support or that are difficult for people. And they've lost their connection on the economic, taken it for granted, I think, that, you know, that people will trust us on the economic issues. That, you know, most people will vote not based on a party affiliation. They'll vote based on when they sit down at the kitchen table and look around at their family. How are we doing? Do we have enough money in the bank to take a vacation this summer? Go on holiday. The car's a little cranky. Do we have enough money for a new car? People will vote based on how's my life? How am I doing? And if you're feeling great, then you'll vote to keep the person who's got the job. And if you're feeling uneasy or negative or nervous, you're going to vote for change.
And, you know, this week alone in President Trump news, we have the tariff threats. We've spoken about them, John. We have the Epstein files, which may or may not exist. We have an ultimatum on Russia and Ukraine, an attack on the chair of the Fed, Jerome Powell. I find it even hard to keep up covering it from here. But what I'm interested in is your reading on what it means long term for your country, the country you love.
Well, number one, again, Trump likes to be the center of attention. So the Ukraine thing I'll put off separately. A lot of people think that, you know, Trump just likes people currying favor with him. And so if you say nice things about him, he will like you. Well, he turned on Putin at some point, and we'll see if that lasts. I think it's very important. It's very important for the future of Europe. It's very important for the future of NATO that the United States take its traditional role as pro-democracy, pro-alliance, pro-friendships. And Trump has not always been there. So the fact that Trump is there now is fascinating. We'll see if it lasts. The Epstein file thing is interesting to me because, you know, if you live a lie, right? Donald Trump came to attention by saying, you know, Barack Obama was not an American. He was from Kenya. He was an illegitimate president. Well, that was a lie. He also said that there was all this stuff about Jeffrey Epstein. And so either that was a lie or now they're hiding something, right? This is the conversation among Trump voters, right? Are they hiding something? Is it even bigger than we thought? Well, if you live by the conspiracy theory, you can die by the conspiracy theory. And so I do think among his own people right now, there's a trust question. And that's very rare. The one constant of Donald Trump since 2015 is that his base, his hardcore base, loves him no matter what. And they stay with him no matter what. So I do think there's a question about, does he hurt him? Is this going to hurt him going forward? But I'll say lastly, Miriam, though, that all those things you talked about, they're all important. I try to look beneath it at the structural things right now. And I think one of the reasons Donald Trump tries to keep generating excitement and new stories is to keep you from focusing sometimes on the other stuff. Manufacturing employment in the United States is down since the inauguration. His approval rating is down since the inauguration. The percentage of Americans who say the country is heading in the wrong direction is up since his inauguration. Those are the kind of data points that tell you, back to that change point, that the midterm elections do not look good for the Republicans right now. And Donald Trump lived this in his first term. He won an election. He had an all-Republican Congress. But then in 2018, the Democrats swept back into power and Nancy Pelosi became Speaker. And essentially, that was a roadblock on the Trump agenda because the Democrats controlled at least one chamber of Congress. I do think that possibility is very real next year, which is why he's trying to do so much in these first 2 years. You get dizzy, right? It's hard to follow because every day there's so many things. You get whiplash every day and you get exhausted. You get exhausted every day. But he remembers. He remembers that he only really got 2 years last time.
Look, I'm about to give the dates now for your public interviews here in September. Before I let you go, can I ask about your health? You sound brilliant. I know you're public about saying you're living with MS, but doesn't seem to be impacting on you at all.
I'm very lucky on the MS spectrum, Miriam, because it's such a cruel disease to some people. Some people go from diagnosis to, you know, a wheelchair or worse, sometimes in months or a year. MS is with me every day, but everybody listening has some challenge in their life, whether it's a health challenge, whether it's some physical challenge, whether it's a family member who has this challenge. Heat, it's very hot. It's been very, very hot in DC right now. Heat is tough for me. I have to stay inside or else I lose my ability to walk and sometimes function in the heat. But I'm blessed. I am so blessed. And I've learned a lot from it. It's made me a tougher person. It's made me a more empathetic person. It's made me understand that, you know, the person who's walking in front of you, who's going to, you used to complain, right? Why is that person going so slow? Get out of my way. Well, maybe that person's dealing with a struggle like I am. So just be more patient. So yeah, it's challenging, but it's also made me a better person. It's made me a more disciplined person. It's made me take care of my health a little bit better and my nutrition and my fitness. So it's okay. It's with me every day. But if you don't see it, then I'm doing a good job.
John King, it's been a pleasure for me to chat to you again. I love chatting to you. You're brilliant at what you do and you're an equally lovely guy. We look forward to seeing you in Ireland again soon. You're going to be in the National Concert Hall in Dublin on Tuesday, the 23rd of September. And then you're going to be in your home county, the Town Hall Theatre in Galway, on Wednesday, the 24th of September. You're going to be interviewed on stage by my colleague and good friend, Dervil MacDonald. And everyone should go to those. John King, thanks so much for chatting to me, and mind yourself.
I hope I get to see you in person when I'm there, Miriam. Thank you.